Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. One of the most important dictums of politics is personnel is policy. Given Donald Trump's growing list of unorthodox appointments, it is difficult to discern what foreign policy his administration will pursue, change or continuity. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Dmitry Babich. He is deputy foreign editor at Komsomolskaya Pravda Daily. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, we'll kick it off with George in Budapest. You know, gentlemen, I was thinking about, you know, how long we've been talking about Donald Trump. And I think it would be fair to say that in all three of us and many others have at least a bachelor's degree in Trump studies. Maybe others have more advanced degrees. I think, George, you may fall into that category. So it should be incumbent upon us to try to figure out what the heck is this man doing? Because he's been in the spotlight about 10 years now. Just think about that, gentlemen. 10 years. He's been the focus of American politics. So, George, when we look at this spat of appointments, and we can talk about individual ones, there are just two things that they all have in common: loyalty to Trump, and they seem to be all fanatical Israel supporters. What else is going on here, George?
Oh, you summed it up perfectly. Exactly. That the distinctive characteristic of all of these people is loyalty to Trump and fanaticism about Israel. And some of them have come to fanaticism about Israel relatively recently. For instance, the would-be director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, was very critical of Israel when she ran for president in 2020. One has to look at the foreign policy team and assume that they will pursue a hawkish foreign policy, an interventionist and a warlike policy. It would be very naive not to do so when you appoint people like Mike Waltz as your national security advisor, Marco Rubio as your secretary of state, and Pete Hegseth as your defense secretary. These are not people that you would expect to preside over a termination of wars. And now, some people are saying, yeah, but it'll be Trump who will set policy. And that's true. It's the president who sets policy. On the other hand, why would you pick these people if what you had in mind was a pursuit of peace? And the easiest way to think about this is, well, let's look at issues like Venezuela or China.
And Cuba.
Cuba, what do you expect this team to do? And of course, you say, well, of course, they expect to escalate against Venezuela. Oh, yeah, so I expect them to escalate against China. What about Iran? Well, of course, they're going to escalate against Iran. But then why is it that when we come to Ukraine, you somehow think that they will pursue a peaceful policy on Ukraine? It doesn't really make very much sense. And you have to think that, yes, Trump does not like war. I think we can say that safely. He doesn't like war. However, as we saw in his first term, he hasn't quite figured out the steps you have to take to pursue peace. Just simply saying peace through strength really means very little.
You know, Dima, George brings up so many good points here. I mean, again, they're loyalty to Trump, loyalty to Israel. But then, you know, there are the Marco Rubios that are fanatical about Venezuela, okay? And then you're going to have others that are still begrudging Russia Gators and China hawks and all that. I suppose Trump can make the claim, and we'll see if it pans out, that he'll be in charge of his foreign policy, unlike he was in his first term. So, I mean, it's really more and more incumbent upon focused on one man, because Trump was, you know, they gave him the runaround when he was president before. So I don't know if that's good news or bad news for the very reasons that George says. I mean, he's against war, but he doesn't know how to make peace. Dima.
Well, that's exactly true. He doesn't want costly wars. I mean, he's not against cheap wars that you can win easily. You know, he probably thought that a war against Iran in the end of his term would be such a war, but thank God, in the end, he decided not to go there. But the problem of Trump is that he doesn't quite understand who his enemies are. I mean, he calls them Reds, communists. They're not, you know, they're a special new kind of totalitarians. And in that sense, the only person with logic among his new appointees, that is Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, she went to war in Iraq. Why? Because she volunteered. You know, why? Because she saw the terrorist acts of 2001, and she is a Hindu. Her religion is Hinduism. So she's absolutely right about Islamists, about Islamists being violent, you know, organizing terrorist acts. And it's a fact that Islamists can consider Hindu people and Jews and a lot of other groups as impure. But the problem is that the adherence of this ultra-liberal ideology, which is prevalent now in Biden administration, in the European Union, these people view a huge part of humanity as impure. All the people living in the so-called autocracies, if you listen to what Biden's people and what the leaders of European countries say about them, they're regarded as somehow impure. Of course, they will tell you, we're not against Russians.
Let me stress, impure ideologically.
Exactly.
Impure world.
I mean, if you ask the European leaders, if you ask Biden, they will, of course, tell you, we're not against Russians. We're not against Hungarians. We're not against Chinese. They just have to become democratic. They have to live in a democracy. But that's exactly what Islamists will tell you about Hindus. We're not against Hindus. They just have to convert to Islam, and then, you know, they will be regarded as totally equal to us. But Tulsi Gabbard went to war in Iraq, and she saw how that ideology, I mean, the ultra-liberal ideology, destroys people, you know, Muslims and Christians, just for the sake of regime change. So her position is very logical. She called herself a hawk in the war against terrorism and the dove in the wars for regime change. But, most of the wars started by the United States and by its European allies and by Israel, these are wars for regime change, you know, like the war in Syria. And Tulsi Gabbard was absolutely right to say that it was, I quote, crazy to support the forces that Europe and the United States supported in Syria. They supported Islamists against President Assad. And she was very logical when she met him in 2017 and when she refused to apologize. What is really fearsome is the reaction of European press and European leaders to the appointment of Tulsi Gabbard and a few other people in Trump's administration. Let me just quote some of the headlines. It's a reason for concern. You know, this is worrisome. This is worrisome that there is a woman in Trump's administration who openly says she is for peace.
Okay, but hang on there. Okay, but see, I can take two questions and combine them for George here. Well, a plus for Tulsi Gabbard is that she's not part of the foreign policy blob. That's why there's so much resistance to her. And then there's the issue of qualification. Now, that's all over the place. Well, look at the Biden administration. Look at his cabinet. What qualifications do these people have? Okay. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary. Marco Rubio, Pete Hegseth, I mean, was a TV anchor, but Ronald Reagan was an actor. I mean, I'm not trying to denigrate or support any of these people here, but I don't really think this is the issue at play, qualifications. George.
No, it isn't. And it's one of these completely bogus arguments that people trot out. Well, you know, the real issue is lack of qualifications. But she, of course, does have qualifications. She actually served. She served in the military. She has taken a consistent interest in matters of intelligence and security. I mean, really, if you were to ask, well, what's her thing? What issues are her thing? It's been foreign policy, a critique of American foreign policy and interventionism. The problem in her case is that she will be in the business of coordinating intelligence. So she won't actually be running an agency. I mean, she'll be collating information from the intelligence agencies and presenting them to the president. But the people with the power will be the people who actually run these agencies. So as you said, she's been in charge of 18 intelligence agencies. Well, she won't really be in charge of the 18 agencies. She would just simply collect information, critique them, and present their findings to the president. So she wouldn't actually be in the sort of the policy-making role. And I think that undercuts her case. Now, the problem with the immediate national security team is that, you know, they learned over the past few months to sound like Trump. This is entirely dishonest. Exactly. This, you know, those people say, well, yes, but, you know, Marco Rubio voted against the $100 billion package for Ukraine and Israel. And he said, yes, he did vote against that. But what was the reason he cited? Not opposition to the policy on Ukraine, but, you know, they're saying, well, there wasn't enough money for the border. You know, that's, you know, it's the border. Also, Rubio knew that as when he cast that vote, then he would pass overwhelmingly in the Senate. So the vote really didn't mean anything. It's not like anything dependent on his vote. The same thing with Mike Waltz. Waltz's critique of the Biden administration had been that it's not doing enough. It's too soft on Putin. So when he also voted against sending more money, again, it wasn't because, you know, I think this is, we should really pursue peace, bring this to an end. It was really that, well, the Biden administration isn't really handling this properly. Should actually be doing more. It should be setting out an agenda. Should be telling us exactly what its intent are. It's a cop out. It's a dishonest response, just like this thing, you know, well, my only problem is the lack of qualifications. You know, the person is lying and isn't telling you why he's opposed to something.
You got to, Dima, before we go to the break here, and Russiagate has made its appearance again. Apparently, Tulsi Gabbard is in Putin's pocket. We heard this from a sitting member of Congress who used to be a spook herself. So Russiagate is also in play, Dima.
Well, nothing surprising about that. You know, the ideology which is now ruling the United States, it is totalitarian because whenever it fails, it is always a person or foreign intervention that failed us. You know, Hillary Clinton was the wrong person to run against Trump. It was not that they basically destroyed the economy, that they carried all the industry to China and other countries. No, it was just the person of Hillary Clinton. Now it's the person of Kamala Harris. We could pick up someone better. And again and again, these are Russian influences. They're influencing us through social networks. Their people are everywhere.
It'll always be a default position for failure. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle here. We're discussing some real news. George, it's a discussion you and I have had in the past multiple times. And I think that we see an intentional fusion or to blur what is neocon and its outlook and the outlook of neocons and America First. People like Marco Rubio, they're trying to fuse them together. And I think that is intellectually and morally dishonest, George.
Well, that's exactly right. Because, of course, America First originally meant in the, you know, in the Charles Lindbergh sense and the sort of the Pat Buchanan who kind of updated it back in the 1980s. So America First meant that we should pursue a policy that is in the interest of the United States and not in the interest of any other country, and that therefore the United States should not be undertaking all kinds of interventions and commitments that serve no obvious American interest. Now how this was transmuted in the minds of the various Trump acolytes is that, well, America just gets to do whatever it wants without any hindrance from anyone else. So we continue to do everything that we had been doing before, but we now say that it's just about America and that it's just in our interest, and everyone else can just simply butt out. And I think that's what the various people, you know, who have taken this America First label to themselves really advocate. So that's why, you know, you get people like Nikki Haley who said, yeah, well, I'm America First, you know, but you know, you're clearly supporting Israel. I mean, everything you do is for Israel. Yeah, well, of course, everything that's good for Israel is good for America. So therefore, When everything goes for Israel, I'm of course advocating an America First policy. And I think that's really the problem. So all of these people, whether Waltz or Rubio, Hegseth, will say, yeah, we're doing America First. But what about all these wars that you intend now to escalate in order to pursue something or other? That's America First. So it's a deeply dishonest exercise in order to reassure Trump and Trump's supporters that we're on board for this. We're definitely no more of these stupid wars for somebody else. No, we'll have stupid wars that are for America First.
You know, Dima, much of the discussion about the future cabinet and other positions of the next administration may be kind of all moot because, there's what I call Vindmanism, where you have the interagency consensus. That's going to be very, very hard to fight against, okay? I mean, Pete Hegseth, popular TV guy, all the more power to him, but to be able to control the largest single bureaucracy in the world with a budget of $1 trillion, you'd think it would take him 4 years to learn how to run the place, let alone run it from day one, because the layers and layers of bureaucracy, they just have a life of their own, an existence of their own. All of these political actors are going to have to face the same thing. In the case of the Pentagon, it's just much bigger, Dima.
True. And it's interesting how, with what hostility these appointments are taken, like Pete Hegseth, he's a cultural warrior. Why should a cultural warrior head the Defense Department? Well, because the Defense Department has been basically violated by cultural warriors from the other side. I mean, we have seen how the military were made woke, even though they are not woke by nature. The same story with Matt Gaetz. I mean, he's against monopoly. And this is very American to be against monopoly. I'm not going to give examples in what ways he's against monopoly. But the main monopoly in the United States now is ideological. If only the Democrats, if only the liberals are the carriers of absolute truth, so you have a monopoly in ideology, why not have a monopoly in economy? Why not have it in government contracts? It is just the same logic everywhere. But just to explain my position, maybe it will be interesting for our viewers if I tell you about the Russian view of all of this.
Okay.
I mean, when I say that people living in autocracies or stemming from autocracies are regarded as impure, I attended the Congress of Russian Speakers recently in Moscow, and people from France, from Britain, from Germany, ethnic Russians coming from there, they tell me stories how their bank accounts were shut down, even though they were, for example, French citizens or German citizens, simply because they had Russian second names. They already were citizens. So one of them, a woman who moved from Russia to France many years ago, who considered herself French, she suddenly felt herself Russian. So when they shut down her bank account because of her second name, she wrote to that bank, "I'm Russian and I'm proud of this. And you consider me impure because of your ideology, because of politics." And for her, it was a revolution because she graduated from the Higher School of Economics, one of the most liberal educational institutions in Russia, and she wanted to be a liberal, And suddenly she saw this, that you are still impure, even if you left Russia.
Liberalism, as it exists in the West now, it's just a warm and fuzzy version of authoritarianism, and we all know that. They have a different idiom. It doesn't come with a jackboot; it comes with a pat on the back. George, there's a real important issue here because, as I started out, we're all kind of students of Trumpism, if we like it or not. We're all forced to be. I strongly believe that legacy is going to play a very big role in Trump's mind as he moves forward. We all know that he won't be running for another term. He's in a remarkable position of day one. He's a lame duck. And as we all know, irrespective if it's a first or second term, you got a window of about 18 months to make to leave your mark, okay? And I have to hope, considering the motley crew that he's going to have around him, that he's going to want history to be kind to him. What do you think he's going to do thinking that way?
Well, I absolutely agree. I do think that he wants to bring the two wars that America is involved in to a swift conclusion. The problem is he doesn't really know how he's going to do it, and he hasn't really put together a team that's likely to achieve it. Now, I think Trump senses that the way you get to peace is by talking very tough, frighten everybody, and then, you know, everybody came, oh, yeah, where's the document? Let me just sign on the dotted line. The last thing I want is to be up against this crazy man in the White House. And I think that's a very dangerous position to take. Because I do think that when it comes to Ukraine, I think he is going to present a peace plan, something along the lines we've talked about before, something that it's been set out in various newspaper articles. I think it'll be unacceptable. I don't think Ukraine will accept it. I don't think Russia will accept it. And then he's going to have to decide what to do next. And I think that he will then escalate, and that I think becomes very dangerous because he could just take it a step forward. We know that Trump has done dangerous things in the past, and the assassination of General Soleimani, again on another territory's soil. That's dangerous stuff.
At the behest of another country.
At the behest of another country, and you can't. And particularly now, as we've seen, the kind of reckless things that Israel has done with carrying out assassinations. Again, you kind of wonder, is there something else that's on the cards? You know, Trump thinks that, hey, let me just, escalate by doing something as dangerous and as reckless as carrying out an assassination. You never can tell. I mean, he's a mercurial person. He does take risks. And I think that's really the problem. And it's the same thing with Israel. I think he could easily take, adopt a very dangerous policy, thinking, hey, well, this is the fastest way to get to peace. Do something really...
It's the most dangerous way.
Exactly. And that's a real concern. He got away with it in the past, like he got away with it with General Soleimani. Next time, he may not be able to get away with it.
You know, Dima, Vladimir Putin has dealt with, we can go back technically to from Bill Clinton, I mean, because they had the transition there. George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and now again, Donald Trump. How do the Russian leadership see American presidents?
Well, I mean, Americans may be surprised, but we have nothing against this slogan, America First. That's normal. We're not expecting to be loved by America. You know, we can provide for ourselves. We know it now. We had an inferiority complex in the late 80s, early 90s. Now we know that we can provide for ourselves thanks to the sanctions. Now we learned. Yep. So America is first is quite okay with us. Putin had a good relationship with George W. Bush, despite the hawkish attitude of George W. Bush. He goes, okay, you love your country. We have no problem with that. the problem is when you start to pit Ukrainian nationalists against Russia, when you start to make former Soviet republics hostile to Russia, when you consider Russians living in the Baltics or in Europe at large as impure, then we have a problem. And that was unfortunately very, very typical for Obama and for Biden. And that's why relations with Biden soured almost from the very beginning. But again, I'm afraid we're going to have the same paradigm now. Usually, when the new president comes to power, fresh from elections, fresh from talking to voters, he always says, I'm going to have good relations with Russia. You know, that was the case with Obama. You remember that he said that was the case even with Biden. Remember the summit in Geneva, Putin and Biden meeting in Geneva. It was also the beginning of Trump's first term. Remember the summit in Helsinki, demonized by the liberal press. So it's always the same paradigm, good beginning, and then more and more influences from the
deep state. Well, I think maybe not a good beginning, but intentions, the intention.
Good intentions in the beginning, and then the deep state comes back.
We'll kind of end on this. I always said the United States and Russia don't have to be friends, but they really shouldn't be enemies, okay? I want to thank my guests here in Moscow and in Budapest, and of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Rostock rules.